From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Can you imagine U.S. Border Patrol agents shooting into Mexico and killing Mexicans who aren't even trying to get into the United States?
Ni 5 segundos en la orilla cuando comienzan a disparar. No, no. Alrededor de nosotros, a 10 metros de nosotros, había mucha gente, niños, señoras.
Investigative reporter John Carlos Frey says that over the past 5 years, 6 people have been killed on Mexican soil by U.S. agents.
We have no idea why Border Patrol agents are able to fire into a sovereign country and not be punished for it.
And going to where California's farm workers live, in toxic mobile home parks.
Como aquí mira usted, hay muchos cables.
Here you can see that there are lots of cables, and it's so dangerous for the children.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On May 12, 2008, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials raided a kosher slaughterhouse in Postville, Iowa. It was the largest immigration raid in U.S. history. Many of the 389 workers arrested were charged with identity theft and later deported. A documentary called Abused, the Postville Raid, which airs this week on PBS, shows the impact that the raid had on the families of the arrested workers and on the town. The filmmaker, Luis Argueta, joins us now by phone from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Welcome to Latino USA, Luis.
Maria, thank you for having me.
So, Luis, for those people who are not familiar, what happened in Postville, Iowa, 5 years ago?
Over 900 federal agents, with the support of helicopters, SUVs, buses, surrounded the largest kosher meatpacking plant in the country and arrested 389 undocumented workers, mainly from Guatemala and also from Mexico. The operation cost $5.2 million.
So you're in Postville for the five-year anniversary. What's the tenor of the town? What's the feeling?
You know, Postville was totally devastated by this raid. Not only were families torn apart, kids were separated from their parents, and not only immigrant kids suffered the trauma of this raid, but also U.S. citizens. Parents would say, you know, my kid cannot sleep because he's afraid that tomorrow they're going to come and pick us up. Postville has come back. The plant was sold and is working and employing a lot of people. It is about 85% of what it used to be in numbers. But the town, the school population has come back, and it shows the resilience of the Midwest.
So your movie, Abused, the Postville Raid, aired on PBS last December. But at the time, Iowa Public Television actually refused to air it. But now, Iowa Public Television says that on the fifth anniversary, they will air the film. So what does this mean to you?
I think it's very telling and very iconic that it's happening for the first time in Iowa when the conversation on immigration at the national level has changed, and we have a lot of hopes for a new immigration landscape in the future.
Luis Argueta, thank you so much for speaking with us from Cedar Rapids.
Un abrazo, María. Muchas gracias.
Luis Argueta is a filmmaker and lecturer. His film, Abused, the Postville Raid, airs on May 12th and 13th as part of the America Reframe series, which airs on the PBS World Channel. Why are U.S. Border Patrol agents shooting into Mexico and killing innocent civilians? That's the question a new investigative report by John Carlos Frey asks. His article appears in the May issue of the Washington Monthly. The story, titled Over the Line, details a dramatic increase in fatal shootings of Mexican nationals on Mexican territory by U.S. Border Patrol agents shooting from the American side of the border. John Carlos Frey joins us in our studios here in Harlem to talk about the piece called Over the Line. Welcome to Latino USA, John Carlos.
Good to be here. Thank you.
When you started looking into this story, Did you immediately realize that these Mexicans were in Mexico and not even trying to get to the United States?
Not initially. The first instance happened in Juarez, Mexico, where a Border Patrol agent shot and fired across the U.S.-Mexico border, killed a 15-year-old boy as he stood in Juarez. And then about a year later, another incident. And then several months after that, another one. And then another one. And now we have six in the past 2 years. That's when it really started to pique my interest. What was going on if federal agents from Mexico were firing their weapons into the United States and killing U.S. citizens? We'd have the army down there. We would have an international incident.
So one case that you outline in your piece is about Arevalo Pedrosa. He's a construction worker. He was at a picnic for his daughter's birthday, and a shootout by the Border Patrol occurs. They're chasing someone on the U.S. side of the border. We actually have a little bit of audio. This is part of your conversation with one of the eyewitnesses of that shooting. Let's take a listen to the audio.
¿Estabas tirándoles piedras grandes?
Nada de eso, señor. Nada de eso. Nosotros llegamos a la orilla y ya de cuenta nomás en lo que llegamos a la orilla no duramos ni 5 segundos en la orilla cuando comienzan a disparar. No, no. Alrededor de nosotros, a 10 metros de nosotros, había mucha gente, niños, señoras.
At that point, you're actually questioning this man, and you're saying, wait a second, didn't you throw rocks? Didn't you throw rocks? That's how it starts, because the Border Patrol has now, on more than one occasion, said, we're shooting because people are throwing rocks at us.
That seems to be part of their protocol. They're actually allowed to open fire. They consider rock throwing a lethal weapon and can return by using lethal force. But the odd thing about this particular instance is they're actually opening fire into a sovereign country. They're firing into Mexico. These people are standing on their own soil. We have no idea why Border Patrol agents are able to fire into a sovereign country and not be punished for it.
I'm sure that there are people who are listening to us, John Carlos, who are saying, well, wait a second. If these people are getting shot, they're involved in something. There are many people who are crossing the border. They're carrying drugs. They're carrying weapons. They're carrying who knows what. So are you saying that all of the people who were shot were entirely innocent victims?
I had the same question. So we did background checks on all of the victims. In 5 of the 6 cases, none of the individuals had any sort of a criminal history. One was a 15-year-old boy. One was a 16-year-old boy. The 16-year-old boy was shot 8 times in the back. In 1 of the 6 instances, we could pretty much deduce that the individual was at the border running people across and probably drugs as well, and he was shot while standing in Mexico. But the interesting thing is the U.S. Border Patrol doesn't have the right to fire into Mexico.
So what does the Border Patrol say about why this is happening?
They say nothing. And that's part of the problem. If you're a reporter and you ask for public documents, if you ask for anything about the investigation, if you ask for details, you get absolutely no response. You know, if you have a local police force like here in New York City, you actually have public scrutiny. You have open investigations. You have a form of transparency. That does not occur within the U.S. Border Patrol.
So, Juan Carlos, stepping back, why do you think that these shootings are increasing?
The line at the U.S.-Mexico border has become a war zone. Immigrants trying to cross the border are no longer perceived as poor people seeking economic refuge in the United States. They are thought of as criminal. They are thought of even as terrorists. There's more of a military footing at the U.S.-Mexico border than ever before. We had a huge increase in Border Patrol forces in 2007 during the Bush administration, and hiring requirements were lowered. Standards were lowered. So we may have poorly trained agents as well.
What are your concerns about what comes next and what should be being talked about in terms of border security?
We have to take a look at and define what border security is. What it appears to be today is a whole bunch of agents armed to the teeth and a lot of technology. And if immigration reform legislation has the caveat of increased border security, we're basically going to have a war zone at a place where we actually have friendly ties with a country to our south.
John Carlos, thank you so much for your work on this project.
Thank you.
John Carlos Frey's report, Over the Line, is in the May issue of the Washington Monthly and was funded by the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund. For more information, go to our website at latinousa.org.
Madre que el tiempo tiene de enemigo, cuidar tu hijo como fiera, por verlo crecer, jugar, correr.
This Mother's Day, or El Día de las Madres, Latino USA editor Lita Hartman remembers her mama with an essay about the important decision to become a mother and the equally important choice not to.
When I was a girl growing up in New York, my mama, Sonia Garcia, had some remarkable things lying around. For starters, there was the big, in-your-face button she wore on her coat. It had two words, the pill. Then there was her plastic model of a woman's anatomy and her squiggly collection of IUDs, intrauterine devices designed to prevent pregnancy. My mama looked every inch the professional lady, all business suits and spiky heels, but in reality, she was a foot soldier in the army of Planned Parenthood, showing other Puerto Rican women in Spanish Harlem in the South Bronx how they could control when and whether to have kids. Revolutionary for 1954. Fast forward a couple of generations to North Carolina. In Chatham County, where I live, there is a whole new baby boom going on, and it's due mostly to the young immigrants whose families have come here from Mexico or Central America. I know a lot of kids who are having kids. Marco became a daddy his senior year of high school. Miguel had two kids with two different girls by the time he was 21. Then there's Javier. He walked across the desert at age 11, drinking out of horse troughs, and was reading Chaucer by age 17. Javier was in his first year of college, even though he had no papers, when his girlfriend announced she was pregnant. Like the other girls, she was a teenager too. Maricela has a whole other story. She was actually on birth control pills when she went to Mexico to visit her boyfriend's family, but she ran out. Her boyfriend's aunt got her more pills, but they didn't work. When Mari got pregnant, everyone in the family was delighted, except for her. Back home, she kept her arms folded across her belly and told me she didn't want this baby. Knowing her family and her community, I knew better than to bring up the A word. What's behind all this? Partly it's that North Carolina has some school districts that offer sex ed, but others that preach abstinence only. There's also the traditional culture that many immigrants here come from. Having a baby isn't seen as a stigma, with or without a partner, in or out of wedlock. It's seen as a symbol of adulthood or the cementing of a relationship, almost as much as marriage is. In big extended families, one more child is always welcome. My mama, if she hadn't been cremated, would be spinning in her grave, all that trailblazing for nothing. But I can't be quick to judge. It is harder to get ahead when you're raising a child and you're barely more than a child yourself. But is there any guarantee that people who wait to have kids will have better marriages or happier families than those who don't? Most of the young parents I know seem content enough. Marco married his girlfriend and they've had two more kids. Javier also got married, and he and his wife are taking turns getting through college. Miguel doesn't live with his kids, but he's helping support them. Maricela and her partner are still together. They've just had their second baby. All of them are carrying on the best they can, just like the rest of us. All I can do is wish them well and wish them a happy Mother's Day. Hey, mama.
Hey, mama. So, are you ready for a different kind of Mother's Day card? Check out our website for a link to the eCards project from Strong Families, where different kinds of mamas are featured. Coming up on Latino USA, the last farmworker residents of a notorious California mobile home park called Duroville say goodbye to it and hello to brand new homes.
I have a big kitchen. I have my own room. My baby has his own room. I'm better here.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. Stay with us.
Mujer, si puedes tú con Dios hablar. Pregúntale si yo alguna vez te he dejado de adorar. Y al mar, espejo de mi corazón, las veces que me ha visto llorar la perfidia de tu amor.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Southern California's Coachella Valley is a study in contrasts. To the west lie Palm Spring and other desert resort towns. But it's farms, not golf courses, that dominate the eastern part of the valley. Here, the land is rich, but most of the people are not. It's home to an estimated 15,000 farm workers, many of whom have no choice but to live in toxic mobile home parks. One of the most notorious, known as Duroville, has been closed under court order. Lisa Morehouse has our story.
Excavators move up and down Duroville's dirt roads before 7 a.m. They're tearing down empty mobile homes once families have moved out to ensure no one else can move in. At its height, Duroville provided cheap housing for thousands of farm workers and their families. But unsafe and unhealthy conditions garnered national media attention. Despite that, 20-year-old Adrian Pena has mixed feelings about the closure of his childhood home.
To be honest, it kind of hurts. It's a very good community with very good people most of the time.
He does point out the place where a poor electrical system caused major fires. And he admits he probably won't miss the muddy floors that he had to live with every time it rained and his mobile home leaked.
Everything else I'll probably miss, because I know I'll always end up calling this place my home no matter what.
Lorena Martinez from California Rural Legal Assistance is going door-to-door surveying the remaining families about when they plan to relocate and where. At one home, the family tells her they're waiting to hear if they've been accepted at a new park nearby, where the last mobile homes are being moved in. It's only 5 miles in distance, but a whole world away. Mountain View Estates has pristine landscaping and round-the-clock security. It's only for former Duroville residents, like field worker Liliana Mendoza. The 26-year-old beams as she shows off the home she shares with her husband, son, and sister.
I have a big kitchen. I have my own room. My baby has his own room. I'm better here.
Mendoza and her family cover property taxes and insurance and pay $50 a month more to rent the lot their home sits on. But she knows she's one of the lucky ones. It's likely there won't be anything like Mountain View Estates built for a long time. It cost $26 million, and much of that money came from the state before big budget cuts. So people here are looking for other solutions. In an office in the nearby town of La Quinta, immigrant rights attorney Megan Beeman sits at a computer with a Google Earth image of Duroville on the screen.
And then if we zoom out from there, less than a mile from Duroville, we can see that there are a number of other mobile home parks that look very similar, including one that's actually bigger than Duroville.
Zooming further, you can see a checkerboard of farmland and open desert.
And then hundreds of mobile home parks.
Some are big, some are small. Some, like Duroville, are on land owned by members of a California Indian tribe. Some parks meet all of Riverside County's health and safety codes. Some don't and suffer from sketchy wiring or borderline septic systems that leak. Beeman says closing all troubled parks would leave thousands of people homeless.
Isn't it a better idea to take the scant resources that we have and rehabilitate it so that it meets, you know, basic health and safety standards, but also provides for the great need that we have?
That idea, to rehabilitate unpermitted parks, is being put to the test at a little place called Valenzuela. Tucked between two major roads in the middle of farmland, 11 families form a close-knit community here. On January 9th, their power went out. In mid-March when I visit, residents are using generators sparingly, a few hours a day, to power stoves for cooking and lights for the kids to do homework. Resident Eva Zamora points to one generator shared by three mobile homes.
Como aquí, mira usted, hay muchos cables.
Here you can see that there are lots of cables, and it's so dangerous for the children.
Aquí está la luz. Este lo tenemos sobre una ventana.
Eva.
Disculpe.
With her two-year-old in tow, Zamora walks me into her mobile home and opens her refrigerator door.
No tengo, usted puede
Here you can see I have nothing in my refrigerator, not even milk for my kids, because it spoils during the day. Look, we can't have anything. We have nothing.
No tengo nada.
When the old electrical system gave out in January, the owner wanted to install a new one, but the county said no because other aspects of the park weren't up to code. Resident Cirilo Ortega.
I understand politics, and I'm grateful that they worry about our safety, but they are not concerned about our needs at this moment. Electricity is vital for the entire world.
Last month, the county said yes, and residents hope to get power back on soon. But many county employees are concerned. Monica Tejas works for the Economic Development Department and says the county wants to help landowners bring parks into compliance. But she says,
just because it's operable doesn't mean that it's safe. And if someone is asking planning department, anybody to sign off on something that they do not know is safe, I don't know who would do that.
Back at the new Mountain View Estates, families gather in the park in the afternoon watching kids play soccer. When Liliana Mendoza talks about moving here from Duraville, her relief is palpable. But she says she thinks she knows why few people are concerned about affordable housing for farm workers. We're invisible, she says.
Most of the people on the city, they don't look for the farmers over here. There's a place over here. There's people living in a bad condition over here.
And that invisibility contributes to the real dilemma here. How residents, housing advocates, and government agencies can balance the need for all housing to be up to code with the reality of people's living situations. For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in the Eastern Coachella Valley.
And for this week, that's Latino USA. Please become our amigos and amigas. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, where we are Latino USA, all one word. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, and Michael Jones. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem, New York City. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, and by the California Endowment, building a stronger state by improving the health of all Californians. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business and Executive MBA program at Yeshiva University. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.